This message is presented to you by Pastor James Moore and New Life Community Church in Kansas City, Missouri. For more information or to donate, please visit newlifekc.com.
One of God's incredible gifts to human beings is the ability to think. Whenever we want to know, comprehend, or apply something, we think practically. And when we want to analyze, synthesize, or evaluate something, we think theoretically. Some people enjoy examining thoroughly, speculating on the what-ifs of life, while others are content with what is. And my son, Alex, he tends to be a theoretical thinker. He's much more comfortable taking action after he's considered all aspects and angles, while I tend to be a practical thinker who is comfortable taking action without much thought. And obviously, his challenge is avoiding procrastination, while mine is avoiding recklessness. You also may have noticed that when I preach, I tend to present simple principles of truth, expecting people to apply what they've heard, even before they fully understand. And some of you do that. Others, however, are more like Alex and would like to have a little better understanding before fully embracing the message. As I've become aware of this, I've tried to develop my theoretical side to be more thoughtful, you know, before taking action, and to allow you to do the same thing. So I'd like to begin this morning by addressing what are considered to be the big questions of life. The big questions of life are, why am I here? Where did I come from? What am I worth? And do I serve a purpose? Now, these are all fundamental philosophical questions, and how you answer those questions will determine how you see the world and how you treat the world and how you treat yourself. Therefore, it's important to resolve these fundamental questions. Now, as we search for the meaning of life, perhaps the most fundamental question is, does God exist? You see, that's a fundamental question because our answers to the other big questions actually hinge on how we answer this one. For example, an atheist's answer to why am I here will be much different than a theist's answer. See, an atheist doesn't believe God exists, which means life must have come about through some natural, impersonal, unintelligent, and ultimately purposeless process. This means we are ultimately as purposeless as the very process which brought us into existence. It means life is just an accident, and so are we. Oh, we may find some short-term reasons for living, you know, like we're here because our parents wanted to have children. But ultimately, we're just accidents, and so are our parents. Life is one big accident, which means we serve no purpose. We will cause no lasting effect, and in the grand scheme of things, our lives are utterly meaningless. Without a creator in the beginning, there was nobody around to put us here on purpose, which means we aren't here for a reason. It's just that simple. As far as asking, what am I worth? Well, without God, we don't actually have any kind of intrinsic value. Our worth is ultimately subjective. I mean, you might think you're worth something, but someone else might think you're worthless. And as long as there's no transcendent assessor to have the final say, no one is ultimately right or wrong. I mean, philosophers generally agree that without an absolute God to make the rules, there's no such thing as a moral absolute. There are only preferences. You don't actually have a right to live. You just prefer not to die. Someone else, on the other hand, might want to kill you, no matter how you feel about it. And Hey, who's to say they're wrong? Without an absolute morality, power reigns supreme. The strong survive and the weak get exploited. I mean, thankfully, most governments see it as their duty to uphold what they see as your God-given right to live. And since governments also happen to be the strongest human institutions, they can enforce morality upon those who don't necessarily agree with your right to live. The founders of the United States put it very well when they declared, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Unfortunately, some governments don't share this worldview, and their people suffer terribly because of it. Now, a theist, on the other hand, their answer to why am I here is based on the existence of a creator God. And whatever the reason was that he created you, that's why you're here. If you're valuable to him, that's ultimately what you're worth. What he says is right is absolutely right. And what he says is wrong is absolutely wrong. We may be free moral agents with the freedom to make moral decisions, but that doesn't mean we get to choose what actually is right or wrong. It just means we're capable of choosing to be right or wrong. God makes the rules. And if God really does exist, then terms like justice, purpose, and morality, they aren't just abstract notions. I mean, God has a purpose for you. That's why he made you. He's the one who instituted morality. And in the end, he'll see to it that justice prevails. That's a really comforting thought to some, but of course it's terrifying to others. Therefore, before asking, why am I here? We first need to ask, does God exist? Because if he doesn't exist, there's really no point in asking, why am I here? I mean, everything is ultimately pointless. Now, I'm going to risk making an assumption that the majority of you hearing me right now do believe God exists, and therefore you believe he created you for a reason. And this means there's a purpose for your life, and that God is going to be holding you accountable for fulfilling your purpose. My sermon today deals with this subject. There's an old Hasidic tradition, you may have heard of it. A large drop of honey is placed on the first page of the Torah, the first time a Jewish child opens the Bible to read it and study it. And the child is instructed to lick the honey from the page, forever imprinting the young scholar with the memory taste of pleasure, the conviction that the study of God's word is sweet. Some call this a sacred pleasure. For most of us, however, pleasure in life is not something we immediately connect to the sacred. Instead, the word pleasure is more typically coupled with another word, guilty, as in guilty pleasure, or even naughty pleasures. It's almost as if we think that finding some activity enjoyable or pleasurable means there must be something wrong with it. And here's my proof. An extra rich, extra dense chocolate torte. What is it usually called? Chocolate decadence. And of course, there's the old standby favorite of devil's food. A while back, AOL came out with a list they dubbed 10 Guilty Pleasure Movies. meaning movies you know you shouldn't like, but you do anyway. You know, maybe like, I don't know, The Blob or some really weepy chick flick or anything with Steven Seagal. So anyway, what are your guilty pleasures? Let me tell you one of mine. It doesn't happen often, but I've discovered that on the rare occasion when Debbie and I are able to get away, I enjoy a good massage. To just lay there and relax for an hour while a trained professional helps get the tightness out of my muscles and eases my aches and pains. You know, that's a pleasure I enjoy. Anyone else like that? Or maybe for you, it's listening to Barry Manilow when no one's around. It's possible that some of you may actually like music that involves an accordion, although you'll never admit it to your kids or your friends or anyone. So what's your guilty pleasure? Maybe a day dug into a sandy beach listening to the waves while sipping on a cool drink. For others, it might be eating your way through an 8-course, 5-star meal, or finishing a carton of ice cream alone. Guilty pleasures. But why do we think we have to feel guilty about our pleasures? Are we secretly convinced that deep down, God doesn't want us to have a good time? That God doesn't want us to enjoy life? Are we under the impression that our Creator couldn't possibly take pleasure in watching His creatures savor what His creation has to offer us? Or do we believe that He loves us like a parent loves a favorite son or daughter, that He delights in giving good things and making sure we have the best? Now, our answers to these are stated quite clearly, although most of the time we're not conscious of the statements we make. But they're more numerous than we think. The reason we're not aware of them is that most of our statements are not verbal. They're revelations of the heart revealed by our choices. As the old saying goes, actions speak louder than words. For example, what are we saying when we have no money to invest in God's work, but we have enough to pay the cable bill? Or when we see people who are starving and we wish we could help, and then we waste money on soft drinks that have no nutritional value? Hey, why does $30 a month to save a child seem like so much, while $30 for a steak dinner for two seems like such a bargain? So, what do our choices say about God? Well, I can tell you, not much. Our choices say more about us. They say more about our values. They reveal what's in our heart. Now, I'm not saying God is an enemy of entertainment or taste buds, but He is an enemy of idols. And our choices reveal what our idols are. Let's read the first verse of our text in Proverbs 3, verse 9. Honor the Lord with your wealth. The sad fact is, we deceive ourselves often. Our enormous capacity for this deception came first with the fall in the Garden of Eden, when sin entered the human race. It's really amazing how much we can afford to do for God's kingdom. The budget is always tight, right? Meanwhile, the vacations we really want to take, they're usually taken. The make and model we want to drive, it's usually in our driveway. It appears we're more comfortable delaying God's gratification than our own. So I suggest that we need to snap out of our unconsciousness. And I say that because many of our idols have become just automatic to us. We don't recognize them as intentional choices that reveal the treasure of our heart. At the same time, however, deep down, we know that if we loved God with all our being, if we treasured His kingdom above all else, we would give more of our treasure for His use. Now you may ask, well, why is this so important? Is God broke? Does He need our money? Well, of course not. The one who owns everything doesn't have a cash shortage, but He wants more than cash. See, the currency of His kingdom is faith. And He wants us to value His currency over the currency of this world. More than that, He wants us. He wants our choices to reflect an intense, unbridled love. He wants our choices to honor Him. After all, creation exists for the express purpose of honoring God. Let's go back to our text in Proverbs 3. Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. Okay, since the purpose of all creation is honoring God, it only makes sense that when He is honored, He will grant increase and give His blessing. And please note, honor gives birth to more honor. In other words, those who deal faithfully in small things will be given greater things. Those who have glorified Him with their wealth will be given more. Why? So they can glorify Him even more. Now let me interject here. Don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that there's a guarantee that if you tithe, you'll become rich. The Bible never says such a thing. The Bible does promise, however, that God will never be stingy with those who are generous toward Him. It's just not in His nature to take and never give. In fact, it's quite the opposite. He always, always gives more than He receives. I mean, if He was willing to give even His own Son for us, why would we think He won't be generous to us with His unlimited resources? Therefore, we must ask ourselves a very important question. Will we honor God as He intended? Or do we only want to have enough to get by? See, a truth that parents need to pass on to their children. In fact, the truth I'm trying to pass on to you right now is the means to greater means is to abandon all to God for His glory. You can be assured that He will not take your all and then refuse to support you. He can't. That's just not who He is. So, can you state unequivocally that you are in line with God's purpose for creation, the purpose which is to give Him honor? And before you answer, let me remind you, this is more than a verbal statement. It reaches into every area of our lives and is actually demonstrated more by our actions than our words. See, God's purpose for creating us is to honor Him. And one way we can honor Him is by dedicating everything we have to Him and giving a generous portion of what we have to His work. See, by this, He is glorified. And this is also how we prove that we can be trusted to handle more resources. Let me ask a question. How many of you know that God has called us to be like Him? Well, over and over again, He's proven that He is, by nature, an extravagant giver. So doesn't this mean that each of us should be an extravagant giver as well? Okay, let's continue by reading the next verse from our text in Proverbs 3, verse 11. Do not despise the Lord's discipline and do not resent His rebuke. Do not despise the Lord's discipline. Do not resent His rebuke. There's much confusion on this subject because our natural reaction when rebuked by anyone, even God, our natural reaction is to take up an offense. We don't like anyone telling us what to do. And we don't think anyone has a right to tell us what to do. I mean, we know God does, but we think God is always on our side, right? That's why when He works through others to correct us, we tell them that our relationship with God is personal and they have no business interfering. That's why when He works through our circumstances, we cry out with why? Why? We do that without considering that He might just be looking for a change in our hearts. The bottom line is this. We have a hard time accepting direction or correction. This is basic nature, basic human nature. We human beings, we run from any kind of discomfort. We spend most of our lives trying to become just a little more comfortable, trying to make things a little bit easier, trying to climb just a little bit higher, trying to avoid pain and hardship, no matter what it costs. And when correction is personal, well, we treat it like a disease. We'll even break friendships with people who remind us of our shortcomings, no matter how gently they may do it. In short, we are creatures looking for superficial peace and comfort. But you see, as disciples of Jesus Christ, we cannot afford that luxury. Let's get real for a moment. The process is this. We begin as abject sinners, and we want to end up as redeemed children of God. So, what are we expecting to happen in this process? Do we really think we're going to grow from this to this without a painful shock to our system? Well, we can't. We have to put up with a lot of correction along the way. And if we don't endure it, listen, if we don't endure it, we can never be remade into God's image. And we can never fulfill our purpose for living, which is to honor God. You see, our problem tends to be in confusing God's rebuke with God's disapproval. We need to understand that His correction is never to condemn, and it's always to edify. Did you catch that? His correction is never to condemn and always to edify. Yes, it may be a painful edification, but it's well worth it. One day we're going to stand in eternity and we're going to pour undying gratitude at His feet for every difficult thing we went through and for all the discipline He imposed on us. We'll be grateful because everything He put on us will have made us more gloriously radiant in the everlasting kingdom. Never doubt, my friend, never doubt that temporal pain exchanged for eternal blessing is a bargain. Always cooperate with His discipline and thank Him for its promise. Okay, let's read one more verse just to cement this truth. Proverbs 3, verse 12. For the Lord corrects those He loves, just as a father corrects a child in whom he delights. Oh, this verse brings such a wonderful truth. You see, generally speaking, we don't give correction to strangers. You know why? Because it's not our place. It's not our place to correct them. We don't have a relationship with them. Therefore, we can take comfort in the fact that God does discipline us because it implies a relationship, and not just a casual relationship either. It implies that He loves us as children and that He's intent on our becoming more like Him. God does not discipline those He's given up on, but He does discipline those He treasures. So let me ask, are you going through a hard thing today? You know, it may be, this hard thing may be discipline from the Lord urging you to change something in your life. Or perhaps it's simply a divine stress test planned to increase your endurance, build your character. But no matter what the specific cause, no matter what is happening, you can be sure of one thing. It is designed to shape you into His image, and He's monitoring. He's monitoring it with great care, even with delight. Why? So that we can fulfill the purpose of all creation, which is to bring honor to our God. Please be encouraged today, friend. You would not be going through your hard thing if God didn't care. You would not be in the painful process of conforming to His likeness if you weren't His child. He loves you. Let me share a story. Jennifer Johnson banged her hands on the steering wheel. "I can't believe it," she screamed out loud. She had put off getting gas, and now she'd run out. She was angry, and she silently cursed her carelessness as she tried to start the car. The engine just would not start. And she stopped trying only when she realized that the battery was getting weak. Well, Jennifer looked around. It was dark, and she was scared. She was in a part of town where there had been riots and National Guard troops just a few days before. So she made sure her doors were locked. She could barely see outlines of large warehouses and railroad tracks and chain link fences. She looked in all directions for a telephone or a service station or a restaurant or anything. There was nothing. She'd not really prayed in years, but she tried as best she could. Her panic began to ease just a bit. She decided that the best thing was just to wait in her car. Sooner or later, someone would surely drive by. Hopefully a taxi or maybe a police car would come along. Then she saw Him. The hair stood up on her neck and her heart began racing. In the middle of the street, coming straight at her, she could make out the form of a large man approaching. "Oh, maybe he won't see me," she half thought and half prayed. "Maybe he'll just walk by." And she slid deeply down into her seat and held her breath. And then, just as she began to think that he had passed by, she looked up, and there he was at her window. He tapped on the glass, and instantly she was hysterical. She screamed at the top of her lungs, "Get away! Don't bother me! Leave me alone!" But he didn't listen. He just kept tapping on the window. He said something, but all she could hear was her own screaming. And then he began yelling at her, and he began beating on the window. He raced around the car. He tried all the doors. She began honking the horn and continued to scream until finally, he was gone. She looked in all directions, but she couldn't see him. Her heart was pounding. She was perspiring heavily. And then to her horror, he came back. And he was carrying a long, thick board. He tried to say something to her, but she started screaming again and drowned out his voice. So he took the board, began to slam it into the driver's side window. On the third blow, it broke in a shower of glass. And before she could react, he reached inside, unlocked the door, and opened it. Well, Jennifer slid to the other side of the car, began to kick at him. He kept trying to grab her, but each time she fought back furiously. Her eyes had become accustomed to the darkness, and through her tears, she was able to see that her kicks had landed because blood was running from his nose and his mouth. But he wouldn't give up. He kept grabbing at her and finally got a grip on her legs and started pulling her out of the car. Well, she was using every bit of strength she had to hit him with her fist and scream at the top of her lungs, but he still managed to get his arms around her waist and began to drag her away. And about 40 feet from the car, he suddenly dropped her and stood up. She immediately scooted away from him on the ground till she backed into a fence. He kept telling her not to be afraid, but she was terrified. She was now about 10 feet away from him, and he hadn't moved. He held his hand on his bleeding face and tried to speak to her, but she started screaming again, saying, "Leave me alone, go away." And after a few seconds, he did, in fact, turn and slowly walk down the street. Well, she just sat there trembling. She began to feel lightheaded and was afraid that she might pass out. But then a strange noise caught her attention, and lights began to flash in the dark night. The ground began to shake as the noise kept getting louder and louder and coming closer and closer. And suddenly, in an instant, she saw it. A train roared past a few feet from where she sat, crashed into her car, and dragged it scraping and banging into the darkness. And it finally sunk in. The man knew about the approaching train. He understood the life-threatening situation she was in. He wasn't trying to hurt her. He was trying to save her. Oh, friends, how often are we guilty of kicking at God and screaming, "Leave me alone," when all he wants is to save us and shape us and position us to fulfill our primary purpose, the purpose of all creation, to honor the one who created us and all the universe. He loves us, and he created us to love him in return. Let's close by reading our text once again. "Honor the Lord with your wealth, with the first fruits of all your crops. Then your barns will be filled to overflowing, and your vats will brim over with new wine. Do not despise the Lord's discipline, and do not resent his rebuke. The Lord disciplines those he loves, as a father the son he delights in." I urge you this morning, church, instead of fighting against him, cooperate. He's preparing you. Honor the Lord with your wealth. Do not despise the Lord's discipline. Do not resent his rebuke. No matter how uncomfortable it seems, our loving Father will never use his tools recklessly. So don't reject him. Cooperate. And as you allow God to prepare you to bring honor to him, you'll find that your cooperation itself honors God. you'll find that you are that son or daughter that he delights in. How awesome is our God? Let's pray. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for the gift of life. Knowing that you have designed each of us with a purpose gives us a sense of worth and value. So beginning now, we make a fresh surrender of ourselves to receive your preparation. May we never lose sight of why we're here. And may all that we do bring glory and honor and praise to God the Father and Jesus Christ, his Son. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message. For more information, please visit newlifekc.com.